got up at night and took a bayonet, put the hilt against the wall, and jabbed it through his chest and killed himself.
Get a hold of the enemy and kill him, so he won't shoot at you anymore.
You're in a dangerous fight with someone, and you finally have him down on the ground, you have a choice. You can finish him off, or you can show generosity, help him up.
I was a Jewish mother to a lot of them. What fun I had.
Coming up, an intimate look at the lives of America's oldest veterans. Born at the close of the 19th century, their lives span one of the most dramatic and tumultuous centuries in human history. They watched America come of age, and we'll take a closer look at their lives, their experiences, and their memories on the World War I Living History Project.
Summer 2006, Kansas City, Missouri. From what looks like a dark underground grotto, history is being recreated. Opened in 1926, the Liberty Memorial was the first large-scale monument devoted to the American veterans of World War I. At night, from the top of the 217-foot tower, appears what looks like a ghostly red flame above the Kansas City skyline, a memorial to the fallen and the unforgotten. Beneath the tower, in the newly remodeled exhibit hall, visitors can peer inside a full-scale version of an actual trench, examine the machinery of war, and share in a multimedia experience that attempts to make sense of what, for most scholars, has been dubbed a senseless event in world history. This is Will Everett. In the first hour, we examine the causes and consequences of the First World War. Triggered by an assassin's bullet, it was the result of a complex tangle of alliances and treaty obligations that pitted the nations of Europe into two hostile camps. With virtually no attempt at reaching a diplomatic solution, armies were mobilized, marching orders were issued, and a war began that would have a transforming effect on European history, on the 20th century, and on a generation of young soldiers. If pride leads before a fall, World War I might be seen as the product of 19th century hubris, the end result of the Gilded Age and decades of plenty. Dr. William Adams is chairman of the History Department of the University of Texas, Brownsville, Texas Southmost College.
When you look at the 19th century, from 1815 to 1914, you know, almost 100 years there, of really solid progress in the world. And I think most people had reached the point where they believe that this progress is possible forever. That is, you know, the outline of, that's the path, the trajectory of history. Get better and better. Standards of living grow. New scientific inventions. Really, it had been a wonderful century in many ways, one of the best centuries in Western history. And then this horrendous war came, and I think the West optimism in the future died. You know, at any time, you can be struck with just a disaster in history. I don't think we've ever recovered that optimism.
It was a preventable war that no one chose to prevent, a war of catastrophic proportions that no one in the summer of 1914 could really grasp. Technology had given the world machine guns, chemical weapons, submarines, and aviation, none of which had yet found expression on the battlefield, nor had another wartime factor been considered in a global conflict, the involvement of the U.S. military. World War I is the story of how the Western world became enmeshed in the bloodiest and most destructive military deadlock that had yet been seen in human history. It's also the story of how a relatively young country experienced its own rite of passage on the world stage, helped break the deadlock in Europe, and found itself a key player in international relations. The U.S. approached the war with reluctance, until its own interests were at stake. As seen earlier, two events were critical in moving U.S. policy away from isolationism to active military participation. Germany's unlimited submarine warfare, which threatened to cripple American merchant shipping, and the discovery of a plot that would pave the way for a possible German invasion through Mexico. On April 6, 1917, the U.S. declared war on Germany.
In
U.S. Treasury Secretary William McAdoo summed up the reasons for American intervention in this fundraising address.
We are by nature peaceful people, but we are a fighting people where the rights of America and of humanity are concerned. The Kaiser insolently commanded our vessels and our citizens not to sail the high seas within a zone of about 500 miles surrounding Great Britain, France, Belgium, and Italy. He said, if you do, I will sink your ships without loading, kill your citizens, and destroy your comrades. If we had submitted to that order, and that had been destroyed, what would have happened? Disaster upon the farms of America. Disaster to the manufacturers of America. Disaster to the mining interests of America. Disaster to the labor interests of America. To every productive activity of the American people, there would have come irreparable injury. Never could we submit to that.
A draft was instituted, and the U.S. military was ramped up from a force of around 120,000 to one of more than 4.5 million. Armaments soon poured from American factories. Training camps were created or expanded to take in the huge influx of new recruits. The American public voiced its unquestioned support of the Wilson administration's war aims, though few knew just what the aim of the war really was. The answer most soldiers gave, we're here because we're here.
We're here because we're here, because we're here, because we're here.
Brigadier General Stephen Burkheiser is executive director of the Liberty Memorial.
If you go back to the beginning, before World War I even started, and look at America, we surely were not a world player politically, militarily, or even economically. We hadn't hit our stride at all. And for the U.S. to make the decision to go into World War I, we were essentially, as President Wilson put together in his 14 points, we were talking about values, about making the world safe for democracy, liberty, democracy. These have been an element of our foreign policy, starting really with the World War I period. And of course, this was our first major deployment, sending military forces overseas.
Tell me of the war of 1917, said his grandson who stood by his side. How did they fix up that terrible mix-up? And proudly the old man replied, the Russians were rushing the Prussians. The Prussians were crushing the Russians. The Balkans were balking, and Turkey was squawking, Rasputin disputing, and Italy hooting. The vultures all bulldozed till they came. The British were watching the sea. But the good Lord, I'm thanking, the Yanks started yanking, and Yankeiser filled up a tree.
And so the United States settled into the realities of a world war, one far away from American shores but connected suddenly to its emerging sense of self. Led by General John Pershing, the American Expeditionary Force embodied the American spirit of independence. While working side by side with the Allied armies of France and Great Britain, Pershing's army was an independent fighting force with its own commander, its own war aims, and its own military muscle. At the Battle of Belleau Wood, when urged by a French commander to retreat, Captain Lloyd Williams summed up the AEF's fighting spirit with his famous reply, "Retreat? Hell, we just got here."
You're a grand old flag, you're a high-flying flag, and forever retreat may you wave. You're the emblem of the land I love, the home of the free and the brave. Every heart beats true on the red, white, and blue, where the devil opposed all rank. Drop your load of wings and sleep for luck. Keep your eye on the grand old flag.
The arrival of the American doughboys brought renewed optimism to the Allied soldiers. They brought their naive American confidence, their good humor, and above all, their determination to, quote, kill the Boche. The American soldiers also brought their differing attitudes toward race relations. African American soldiers were segregated or placed in non-combat roles. Many of the black U.S. combat units were handed over to the French for use in the trenches, which for most African American soldiers would be the only time they would fight side by side with white troops. Back home, the roving eye of racial injustice had moved from African Americans to German-speaking immigrants. The late 19th and early 20th century had seen the largest influx of European immigration in American history. Many unassimilated German speakers lived in German districts, read German language newspapers, and shopped at German markets. In 1917, James W. Girard, former U.S. ambassador to Germany, gave a speech to the Ladies' Aid Society in which he suggested that action should be taken against any Germans who questioned America's commitment to beating Germany.
Fortunately, the great majority of American citizens of German descent have, in this great crisis of our history, shown themselves splendidly loyal to our flag. Everyone had a right to sympathize with any warring nation. But now that we are in the war, there are only two sides, and the time has come when every citizen must declare himself American or traitor. And if there are any German Americans here who are so ungrateful for all the benefits they have received that they are still for the Kaiser, there is only one thing to do with them, and that is to hogtie them. Give them back the wooden shoes and the rags they landed in and ship them back to the fatherland.
For the veterans of the First World War who were too young to fight, like 106-year-old veteran John Babcock, who spent the war in England as a 16-year-old in the Young Soldiers Battalion, the horror was often experienced secondhand.
My brother, my half-brother Manley, he bought me out for joining the Army. He joined the engineers and became a sapper. They would dig tunnels under the enemy's lines, and they'd put a bunch of explosives in there and then blow them up. He said he dug into one tunnel one time where the Germans were. The tunnel had been blown in behind them, and they were just sitting there. They were dead. Used up the air that was in that place, and wasn't any place for him to go. He got buried up to his waist one time, and he had a nervous breakdown after he got out of the service.
But training camp was a wartime society of its own and brought its own contact with death. Babcock remembers two fellow soldiers for whom the pressure of war was too much.
He was from Germany, and I think that he'd done something in Germany, and they were catching up on him, and he found out about it. And he came in, and he'd been on guard, and he says, "Well, boys," he says, "here goes." And there was a first sergeant there. He said, "Give me that gun." But he says, "Don't try to get this gun." And he did shot himself. He put the gun in his head and pulled the trigger. Well, I was right there when he did it. Then I remember one time there was this kid got pack drill. You'd have to put your pack on and walk around the barracks. It hurt this kid's feelings so to do this that he got up at night and took a bayonet, put the hilt against the wall, and jabbed it through his chest and killed himself. Jeez, I felt sorry for that kid, because it really was not much of a disgrace to have pack drill, but it hurt his feelings so that he killed himself.
Soldiers defending America's southern border were not immune to the stresses of war, as Samuel Goldberg remembers.
There was an older man from Oklahoma. He looked 60. He was, I think, 33 or 4. And they used to call him Pop because he was so old. He was whiskey-soaked. And he said to me one day, "I'm going to go over the hill. I'm sick and tired of this." Over the hill means desert, run away. And I sat down. I said, "They'll follow you. They'll pick you up in your hometown in Oklahoma, and they'll send you to prison." I said, "You don't do it. You feel lonesome, come see me, we'll talk a little," and so on. I was a Jewish mother to a lot of them. What fun I had.
The war, which many in the summer of 1914 thought would be over by Christmas, had dragged on for nearly three deadly years by the time the main force of U.S. troops arrived in the winter of 1917 and 1918. Pershing hoped for an American rather than an Allied victory, and his tactics centered on pushing back the German line and moving the war to German soil. American Army and Marine forces proved instrumental in breaking the German lines, but soon even the indomitable Pershing was caught in the quagmire of the Western Front. Belleau Wood, the Argonne Forest, the Meuse, and Saint-Mihiel were soon familiar place names to Americans back home. 110-year-old Tony Piero is the last American veteran who saw action at the Argonne and Meuse offensives.
You get in the army, a wartime, your life is not yours. You're there to be used. You have an enemy, you want to kill him. That's the aim, that was the idea. Get a hold of the enemy and kill him, so he won't shoot at you anymore. The enemy is always looking. Shoot to kill. What's the sense of shooting at each other? Somebody's going to get killed. It's nice to be in peace and do what you want. Nobody tells you what to do. You do it your own way.
As is often the case in war, taking prisoners often posed logistical problems. The trench fighting and the constant threat of attack made it impossible to construct detention camps. On the other hand, prisoners couldn't simply be released. John Babcock.
The boys, after you've been in the front line and fighting for a while, you got kind of callous about life. I heard the veterans talking about when they take German prisoners, and they were escorting them back to the air, they'd take them back to the reserve trenches and shoot them. Jesus, I thought that was terrible. It was terrible. But when you get in war, you get hardened to life. Life doesn't mean a hell of a lot to you anymore.
The newly arrived Americans were perhaps less hardened than their war-weary allies. Tony Piero.
In the army, when they get caught prisoners, they get rid of them. They don't fool around. They shoot them. Target practice. Sure, that's what they're using for. They use it for target practice. The Americans didn't believe it that way. The Americans are taking a prisoner, and they treated them as prisoners.
The Germans responded to the arrival of the U.S. with an all-out offensive aimed at cutting through to the Channel ports and reestablishing their maritime supply lines. Despite the departure of the Russians and the end of fighting on Germany's eastern border, the Germans were no match for the remounting strength of the Allies, nor could the German population keep up with the need for new bodies and provisions. In an act of desperation that would be repeated in the next World War, Germany sent its children and middle-aged men to don guns and fill the gaps. But soon the Allied steamroller left the Germans with one alternative. With the threat of revolution in Germany and pressure from the United States, Kaiser Wilhelm II abdicated. And on November 9, 1918, Germany was declared a republic. 2 days later, at the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month of the year, the guns were stilled. And all was quiet on the Western Front.
I couldn't believe it. Really. The war was over. Oh boy. What a day. The sergeant came out and told the story that the peace was declared and let's be happy. That we are still alive. It was just like a new day. Just like the sun had come out of the cloud.
George Johnson.
We heard the war was over. Oh boy, we couldn't get out of there quick enough. That morning, the guys running down the road hollering, the war's over. We couldn't believe what they were talking about. Thought they were drunk or something.
Lloyd Brown.
Oh yeah, a big celebration, yeah. Hugs and kisses from the girls on the streets. In Philadelphia, that's where I was. But anyway, they were giving the service people a good time.
Frank Buckles.
The war was over. America wanted to forget about it. And I realized that my experience was an important thing.
These are the notes of the last post, a trumpet call which is performed each night at the Menin Gate outside Ypres, scene of some of the worst fighting in the war. With so many monuments, so many cemeteries, the First World War has never been far from the Western European consciousness. Drive through any Belgian, French, or German town, large or small, and the first thing you'll come to is an obelisk inscribed with the names of the town's World War I losses. Similar monuments adorn the town plazas and courthouse squares of many American cities, though America's memory of World War I has been overshadowed by the Second World War. General Steven Burkheiser, Executive Director of the Liberty Memorial.
Well, great events typically overshadow the great events that came before them, and World War II surely did that, and especially in the American conscience, because we were involved in World War II almost from the beginning, whereas we were relatively latecomers to World War I.
Frank Buckles.
The emphasis on always the last war, and I don't think that the country ever realized the importance of what World War I meant, and it was the whole world was involved in it. A very serious business.
The First World War had few clearly defined heroes or villains. It was a war fought not in response to the sweeping, maniacal ambitions of a Hitler, but in response to treaty violations and national pride. America entered the war to make the world safe for democracy, as Wilson put it, though with clearly defined national interests at heart. The United States lost some 57,000 men in the roughly 18 months that U.S. troops were committed in Europe. U.S. involvement was critical in breaking the long deadlock along the Western Front and bringing a speedy end to a war which might have raged on in the old European fashion for another decade or more. Dr. William Adams.
I do believe that had we stayed out, the British and the French and their allies with their empires would have eventually defeated the Germans, but it might have taken, you know, another 20 years, like during the Napoleonic Wars. I think it was clear that the bulk of the right was on the side of the British and the French. I would have preferred the world they would have made to the one that the Germans would have made.
Dr. Anthony Knott, Professor Emeritus of the University of Texas, Brownsville, Texas Southmost College.
In the peace agreement, the greedy elements on the winning side took advantage of the situation and benefited themselves and set up situations that would later come back to haunt Europe.
For a very short while after World War I, after the peace treaty, I think countries saw the fact that the democracies had been victorious. France, Britain, America, the strongest democracies were victorious. I think that gave added impetus to the idea of a democratic country. I think before World War I, a lot of people thought that the autocratic countries such as Germany, Russia, Austrian-Hungarian Empire, because of the fact they don't have to bother with parliamentary debate, the slowness of democracy, in wartime would be more efficient. But in the end, it was those great autocracies that collapsed. The Russian Empire, the Ottoman Empire, the Austrian Empire, the German Empire. So I think for a short while, people saw, the way to go is with a democracy. But before the 20s were out, already we saw that the democracies were struggling with the Depression in 29, inflation, the Weimar Republic in Germany failed. So I think it was very short-lived.
The war officially ended in June 1919. 7 months after the armistice, with the signing of the Treaty of Versailles. Here a defeated Germany was forced to accept full responsibility for the war, to restore territories taken half a century earlier, to decommission its military, and pay reparations that would prove devastating to the already crushed German economy.
The big three had completely different goals for the treaty. David Lloyd George was mainly there to extract as much money as he could out of Germany. Tiger Clemenceau, for the French, I think is simply looking for security. The idea of first breaking up Germany came to mind, perhaps break it down into as many as a dozen smaller countries as it had been before it was unified. And then you had the idealist, Wilson, to show up with his 14 points, completely at odds with the other two. I think if either one of them had gotten their way, we would have had a better peace. Had Lloyd George and Clemenceau had their way, they would have crushed Germany. I don't think there there would have been a Second World War. They would have not risen. Or had Wilson had his way, maybe with the idealism, generosity towards Germany, the motive for revenge wouldn't have been there. You know, if you're in a dangerous fight with someone and you finally have them down on the ground, you have a choice. You can finish them off, or you can show generosity, help them up, help dust them off, pat them on the back, and maybe you can get along in the future. The peace we had, it would be like holding the man down, poking out one of their eyes, breaking one of their arms, and kicking them. But they're going to be able to get up eventually, and they're going to be angry.
9 years after the controversial treaty was signed, Frank Buckles was traveling by ship to Germany when he met two well-connected Germans who took him in their confidence.
He says, "We're going to tell you something that will surprise you and you don't know. We're planning for another war." And they both of them had been officers and high-ranking people. And they said, "We're not in favor of it." And many of the other officers of good backgrounds are opposed to it. But nevertheless, we are going to have another war. And that was 10 years after the armistice.
World War II might be seen as the continuation of World War I. The old monarchies and rivalries may have been a thing of the past, but national pride ran just as strong in the late 1930s as when a Serbian nationalist fired into the Austrian Archduke's motorcade. The Versailles Peace Treaty brought closure to the First World War, but the peace was only temporary. In a moment, a final tribute to America's oldest veterans as the World War I Living History Project continues.